Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. There was a time when the Munich Security Conference did focus on pan-European security. Today, it shows itself to be some kind of struggle session, trying to understand what went so wrong, all the while trying to convince themselves of their greatness. Also, what exactly is Trump's Iran policy? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark here in Moscow. Mark, you know, over the years, we've covered the Munich Security Conference, pretty dull stuff usually. 2007, there was kind of an exception. President Putin addressed it, and we've talked about it on this program. But now it looks like some kind of struggle session, group therapy. Very contradictory. Oh, there was fat shaming involved. Numerous glimpses of Kaya Kallas grimacing. And then, you know, we had like Marco Rubio, the usual snake oil salesman, doing some kind of uplifting group. It was like a corporate a camping ground in my mind. Not much was talked about security. Oh, and one thing I did learn is that Ukraine's winning. So maybe you saw something different that I didn't. Mark.
The Munich Security Conference has long been the preeminent security meeting for NATO, right, in Europe. It has held that position. Of course, nothing very significant has happened there. We had 2007, Putin. Speech. We had 2022 when the Europeans were gloating over the impending conflict they were promoting and how they thought Western sanctions would smash Russia's economy and they would be picking Putin out of their teeth the next year. And fast forward to where we are in 2026. The Iranian government called it a circus.
And, well, that's what I'm calling this program, the Munich Circus. Go ahead.
I got a little bit of a different impression. I think it was more of a circus maximus, that it was a gladiator ring, not so much a Ridley Scott gladiator epic, but more one of the modern interpretations, like the Spartacus in a B movie role, blood, sex, and sand kind of thing, because the Europeans were baying for war. They were baying for war against Russia. They were baying for war against Iran. They were literally cheerleading U.S. for regime change in Iran. And despite all the inflated rhetoric, the simultaneous rollout of the terrible, very horrible, terrible, no good, very bad day war game results that NATO has had on several instances when you know they're trying to role play out a future conflict with Russia that they're obviously intent on provoking. They perform absolutely terrible. And the Germans can't even put together a single brigade of troops station in
Given history, that's a good thing, okay, in my opinion. Western media is focused a lot on the introduction of AOC, Sandy Cortez's debut, pretty much what you would expect from a dilettante. She's in op here. She was there. But the Russians weren't there. So how can you talk about security in Europe if the Russians aren't there? Or does it end up being, as George likes to use and I like to copy, just a supper club?
Well, it was a supper club. And the AOC business, of course, is quite interesting because there was a very substantial democratic contingent there. And it wasn't just AOC. There was Gretchen Whitmer. There was, the entire panoply of democratic lawmakers and would-be presidential candidates. And without question, this was, NATO's attempt to groom what they hope will be a change of power in 2028. And so I think Hillary Clinton was there, which is also, she hasn't been in power in 13 years. But, you know, she was there, you know, talking the usual nonsense, you know, tomahawks and reviving the Russiagate. It was still there's some Trump-Putin plot. But you're absolutely right. The Russians were not there, which makes the whole thing just bizarre, because you're talking about the future of European security. Well, how can you talk about European security if you don't have the Russians there? You know, anyone just representing the Russian point of view, you don't even have to have the Russian foreign minister. You don't have the Russian deputy foreign minister, just somebody. So, you know,
we could have done it. We could have done it.
Exactly. Somebody. And they didn't. And so they just simply went around repeating one another's talking points. But I think Mark is right, because there was very belligerent talk from Friedrich Merz of Germany. He was talking about how, you know, he's going to make the Bundeswehr, you know, the most powerful army in Europe. There was a lot of quite belligerent talk from Keir Starmer. And then, of course, all the hangers-on, you know, Mette Frederiksen, the Denmark, you know, just a few weeks ago, she was screaming hysterically that the Americans were going to take Greenland away from her. Now she was, you know, on the panels advocating more and heavier bombing of Russian territory. So this was very much a call to war. And essentially, they were just telling the Americans, your plans for some kind of a deal on Ukraine are null and void, because we're basically telling Zelensky to say no to anything at all that you propose.
You know, Mark, also, I didn't know, we live here, but again, the trope of the Russian economy is crashing. This is, you know, they're constantly recycling all of it. I mean, if a major economy is crashing, how can they be a military threat? They don't really kind of, those two things kind of exist at the same time, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, we heard really the standard Russophrenia tropes, where Russia is simultaneously incompetent, moving at a snail's pace, eating pigeons, fighting with shovels, out of this and out of that. And at the same point, is about to invade NATO and take over the quote unquote free world, where they arrest you for Twitter posts and so on. And it must be said that we heard a lot of the very same propaganda Kool-Aid tropes about Iran, Iranophrenia. We need to coin that, because I don't know what Iran threat Iran poses to the United States, much less Europe. But the Europeans, you know, I believe it's really just a way of currying Trump's good favor.
Yeah, but Trump isn't trying to solicit it. I mean, don't they kind of wake up and like it? It doesn't work.
They don't have to solicit it, right? The Europeans will jump at showing any sign of submission to try to maintain some type of transatlantic relationship. And Merz, George talking about Merz, you know, fan fiction reality where Germany is a military power. The German defense minister, Boris Pistorius, just noted this week that Germany is all out of military equipment to send to the Kiev regime in Ukraine, so they'll send money. They're unable to meet 10% of recruits to staff a single brigade for placing in the Baltics. They're not able to get 10% of people willing to serve. And on top of that, at this Operation Hedgehog war games that we found out was held, a single unit of 10 Ukrainian drone operators representing the Russians in this war game, utilizing less than half of the drones, Russian drone saturation that they are facing on the contact line from the actual Russians, wiped out, decimated two NATO brigades. Get real. These people live in a complete fantasy world that doesn't bear the slightest resemblance to reality, whether it's their depiction of the Russian economy or their fantasies about their own military strength.
You know, George, we had two major political figures. Well, we had Marco Rubio, for example. He skipped over in tandem the year before. We had Vice President Vance there. What kind of message is being sent here? And, oh, Witkoff and Jared Kushner are again part of negotiating. I think they're going to be meeting in Geneva. What is the significance of that in this weird pep talk?
Yes, it was. I mean, Rubio was essentially delivering the same speech Vance delivered a year ago, but much more soothing, much less acerbic, much less aggressive. However, as far as the Europeans were concerned, they were not at all happy with his speech. They noted he only mentioned Ukraine once. I mean, they were preoccupied with Ukraine. He mentioned Ukraine once, but only in the context of, yeah, we're trying to bring an agreement on Ukraine, and President Trump is working, you know, to do this. And even when he talked about Russia in the Q&A, it was very much in the tone of, yeah, well, we're trying to work something out with them. Very different from what the Europeans were saying. Also, he skipped the meeting. There was going to be a Munich Security Conference foreign ministers meeting on Ukraine. And he said, oh, I have a scheduling conflict. But the point is, as far as the Europeans were concerned, essentially, they were encouraging Zelensky, and Zelensky, of course, took the bait to saying, don't make any concessions. We know, yeah, the Americans are trying to press you to give up territory or whatever. Don't do it. We've got your back. We're going to keep supplying you with everything you want, and we're going to do this in perpetuity. So don't listen to the Americans. And Zelensky kind of gleefully said, yeah, we're not going to give up anything. So essentially, they were telling Rubio, well, you can have your meetings all you want. Nothing is going to happen.
Yeah, well, that means the divisions will remain. Real quick, Mark, Navalny's name was resuscitated here. It was, you know, they threw everything, but the kitchen sink. Maybe that is the kitchen sink at all of this here. Apparently, according to von der Leyen, five countries have determined that Navalny was poisoned, though they never had access to his body. Ian Proud, a friend of the program, said, well, five countries agree. What about the other 22? Just real quick, on that, Mark.
Yeah, if Navalny was poisoned and they have information how he was poisoned, well, then it tells us who poisoned him. That's all I have to say there. They're trying to create another martyr figure.
I think that's a very, very subtle way of explaining that drama that they resuscitated. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. We're discussing some real news, and that news, George, is please explain to me, if it's possible, there is limited time, of course, what Trump's Iran policy is here. I'm asking you the easy questions. Go ahead.
Well, it's very hard to know, because we remember from a year ago when he, you know, suddenly he got in involved in that Israel's war. Israel had been launching these attacks on strategic targets in Iran. Trump then...
George, say the words with me. Regime change. Just...
Well, he didn't say it then. Yeah, he says it now. I mean, he did not say it then.
He did say it then. No, he had a Twitter post about it.
He limited himself to... to the attacks on the Iranian nuclear facilities. And he still... As far as, you know, publicly said, no nuclear weapons, no nuclear weapons, no nuclear weapons. That's what he keeps repeating. Now, what he said really just a few days ago, was, I think, a marked shift from what he had been saying. But because now he is saying, well, best thing would be a regime change. But of course, that creates problems for him, because of course he can put in, you know, one aircraft carrier group and another aircraft carrier group. That isn't going to deliver regime change for him. So he's now, yeah, got three aircraft carrier groups, but he's not going to get a regime change. But as far as the negotiations...
Well, at least not through military...
Not military means, that's right. But as far as the negotiations, also in Geneva this week, the Iranians say, well, we're only discussing the nuclear issue. We're not discussing anything else. So then what is Trump going to be discussing? I mean, they said that all that's going to be talked about is the nuclear issue. Then there's even the ballistic missiles issue is not going to be discussed. So... that's why the whole thing is baffling. What he says is very different from what the ostensible negotiations are about.
Well, Mark, in George's defense, Trump has said just about everything possible about Iran at one point in time. So that's why I asked George the easy question, what is the policy? What is the policy, Mark?
Yeah, it's regime change. They just can't figure out how to do it, right? That's always been the policy. The nuclear issue has always been a red herring. In 2025, they only used it for the U.S. to come in, drop some bombs, declare victory, to demand a ceasefire for Israel, because their own air and missile defense, that of the U.S. and Israel, was exhausted. And a long-range strike war of attrition was turning in Iran's favor. And by the way, that's the principal reason why there won't be a regime change again, other than the stability and popularity of the Iranian government with the Iranian people, is that the U.S. and Israel's Achilles heel is still air and missile defense. Their systems aren't good enough. The Patriot and THAAD are practically antiquated in today's terms, not able to meet the demands of modern Iranian cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, long-range drones, even hypersonics, by some assessments. And they don't produce enough air defense interceptors. The Wall Street Journal has told us that right on the front page again and again. It is a hard geopolitical limit on American power now. Iran, it's different from Venezuela. Iran can strike back. Venezuela couldn't. That's why, and the weakness of the regime, the infiltration, Delcy Rodriguez quizzling that she is with turning over Maduro. Iran is a very different beast.
It's very interesting. Another Achilles heel, George, is that all these weapon systems generated by American arms companies are so, so expensive. Their shareholders make a fabulous fortune over it. But, you can't make very many of them. And during the 12-day war, a lot of them were expended. But, Trump, his... instinctively, and I think, if we look at last year, he actually wants a deal. The Israelis don't want a deal. And the Israelis, it appears, would agree to a in-boom-out strategy. That's what he's interested in. The Israeli intelligence and American intelligence, they know that's not going to be possible. So Netanyahu doesn't want him to attack, but if he does attack... which they want, they want him to do, they want a forever war. And that's what Trump is actually resisting, a forever war.
That's right. And that's really, if one look at the track record of all of Trump's military adventures, going back to the first days of his first term, there was always in and out. In the two attacks on Syria, the assassination of Soleimani, the assassination of Baghdadi, the seizure of Maduro, and then of course last year's the attack on the Iran's nuclear facilities. It's in and out. he's not a John McCain character. He is a very much a pragmatic. He's a businessman. He does not want anything that is going to be a disaster. He knows perfectly well a prolonged war with Iran, which will be inconclusive. He's not going to get his regime shift. So it'll be a prolonged war. There'll be American casualties, and it'll be inconclusive. And he's going to have to essentially then call it quits after a while, obviously with egg on his face, if not worse. So that isn't the way Trump is thinking. Trump always wants something, you know, quick. And I would think he's doing now is hoping that he can get some kind of a deal that he can then sell. The meeting with Netanyahu, that didn't seem to produce anything. I mean, he was brought in, Netanyahu through the back door, disappeared. There was no joint presser before or after the meeting. Netanyahu bundled out. And then the truth that Trump sent out was fairly noncommittal. I mean, more or less distancing himself from Netanyahu.
So yes.
We're going to continue negotiations. And therefore, this is something that's different. So we don't know. I mean, as you said, Peter, we simply have a hard time figuring it out. I find it difficult to believe Trump is going to get himself involved in a protracted, inconclusive war.
Yeah, but Mark, it seems to me at this juncture there's a lot of apocalyptic thinking. I think we've all agreed on this program is that the Israelis will probably never have such a pliant American president. And that means, you know, that allows you to think apocalyptically. It's just like finally coming, resolving the Iran file. And I think that still is very much in play here because the stakes are really high. Let's say under one bizarre scenario that, you know, due to a number of reasons, there's a regime collapse in Iran. That would be a feather, presumably, in his hat. But the likelihood of that happening is so small that it isn't worth it. What is it? The juice is not worth the squeeze, Mark.
Yeah, quite obviously, Netanyahu is doing everything he can to push the U.S. I mean, not that the U.S. needs much pushing. Lindsey Graham is practically frothing at the mouth over the whole affair. There are enough people within and without of the Trump regime in the United States who want a conflict. And Israel knows they'll never have a better chance. So they're going to have the lobby put all their influence, all of their paid agents in the United States, Trump being one of them, with his Trump first policy. They're going to do everything they can. They will promise him all the quick and dirty regime changes in the world. But two of them haven't worked so far in the last year, and they don't really have any options for a third one. But we saw the same rigmarole. Oh, that there's a rift between Netanyahu and Trump, and Trump doesn't want the war, but Netanyahu does, and Trump wants a mafia style deal, but Netanyahu doesn't. And last year, that was all cover for an Israeli sneak attack in Iran. So the Iranians aren't being fooled.
But no regime change.
Russians and the Chinese aren't being fooled.
No regime change.
They're taking it very seriously.
George.
Yeah, there was no regime change. I mean, like, you know, yes, Netanyahu wanted regime change last year. There was no regime change. Trump brought it to an end immediately after the attack on the nuclear facilities. So, yeah, I mean, there obviously is a distance between Trump and Netanyahu. No question what Netanyahu wants. Trump probably, in principle, would like to see the regime gone in Iran. However, he isn't going to expend valuable U.S. resources and prestige in trying to get done something that cannot be done.
Mark? That's the rift. The real rift is between capability of what Trump and Netanyahu want and what the U.S. military, CIA, and Mossad are able to deliver.
Yeah, but Mark, what again, going back to the word apocalypse here, the real issue is the long-range missiles. And Iran has demonstrated it has deterrence. And this is what's got the Israelis panicking, because we don't know, and I'm not an expert in this, but it looks like they've gone, it's tipped over to the other side, where they actually have real deterrence. The only country in the region that is a deterrent to Israel, and it's only going to get worse for them, for the Israelis. Mark.
And that's what they're worried about. And they're worried that new Iranian military cooperation with Russia and China will lead to a further deterrent of a more substantial air and missile defense for Iran than they have currently. That's another reason why both the U.S. and Israel see, no matter how low their chances are now, the window of opportunity is narrower to the future. This is pushing them to desperation. This is why we're talking about three carrier groups in the U.S. The U.S. military is facing imperial overstretch. They're dragging it from playing babysitting duty over Venezuela and Cuba in the Caribbean to the Middle East. Why? Because they don't know what else to do at this point.
You know, Mark, I'm sorry, George, Trump, what he needs to do is find a way to declare a victory and go home. How does he do that?
I think it's going to be difficult, because the deal that is on the table and that he could very easily accomplish is the one that he could have accomplished.
He's the guy that walked away from the JCPOA.
He walked away with it in 2018. He walked away from the negotiations last year. And so he's essentially got himself into this problem that he never needed to. I mean, that he absolutely never needed to. This was not something that he promised during his presidential run. And so he's now essentially pushing something that cannot succeed. So how does he walk away? I think, take the deal that's on the table. Not a bad deal. He can easily sell it to say, oh, this is better than the JCPOA. Fine. If you want to say it, say it. But it's on the table. Anything else is going to be a real problem for him.
I really enjoy asking George the easy questions, because he always gives good answers, and so does Mark. That's all the time we have. I want to thank our guests here in Moscow and in Budapest. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.